Today is May the 22nd, 2019. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon are using your personal data? Is that product you bought from Amazon a counterfeit? You should find out. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet, as well as on various podcast hosting sites. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday, it's 6 p.m. Eastern Time, and the number is 641-793-7091. For those who are listening to the program on demand, you can leave us a message with your question or comment to Hank at PCRadioshow.org. You can also reach us on the Google number 862-800-6805. That's 862-800-6805. And start your message with saying "The Personal Computer Show," followed by your message. A technical alert. More than 20,000 Linksys wireless routers are regularly leaking full historic records of every device that has ever connected to them, including devices' unique identifiers, names, and the operating systems they use. The data can be used by snoops or hackers in either targeted or opportunistic attacks. The Linksys routers were leaking unique MAC addresses. Exploiting the flaw requires only a few lines of code that harvests every MAC address, device name, and operating system that has ever been connected to each of them. A 2014 patch was given, however, it's been found to fail to fix the vulnerability on the routers. The devices are vulnerable even when their firewall is turned on. The vulnerability makes it easy for hackers to quickly scan for devices that can be remotely to be taken over. Hackers can then obtain the Wi-Fi SSID password in plain text, change the DNS settings to send connected devices to malicious addresses, or carry out a range of other compromises. Independent researcher Troy Murch said the leak is the result of a flaw in almost 36 models of Linksys routers. And the list of vulnerable Linksys routers can be obtained on either our website, which will be listed, and it'll be posted at pcradioshow.org, or the website is pastebin.com/raw/capital Z capital H small g capital W small n small u numeric 4 and capital C. People using one of these devices would do well to test it if it's leaking device history to the internet even after installing the 2014 update. It is, users should either replace the router with a newer model or replace the Linksys firmware with a third-party offering such as OpenWRT. That's OpenWRT. This is a very serious data leak. Microsoft is warning users of older versions of Windows to urgently apply a Windows update to protect against a potentially widespread attack. Microsoft has patched a critical remote code execution vulnerability in remote desktop services that exist in Windows XP, Windows 7, and server versions like Windows Server 2003, Windows Server 2008 Revision 2, and Windows Server 2008. Microsoft is taking the highly unusual approach of releasing patches for Windows XP and Windows Server 2003, even though both operating systems are out of support. Windows XP users will have to manually download the update from Microsoft's update catalog. This vulnerability is pre-authentication and requires no user interaction. In other words, the vulnerability is wormable, meaning that any future malware that exploits this vulnerability could propagate from vulnerable computer to vulnerable computer in a similar way as the WannaCry malware spread across the globe in 2017. Attackers will likely start making malware now that patches are out. Microsoft says it hasn't observed exploit of this vulnerability, but now that the patches are being released, it's only a matter of time before attackers reverse engineer Microsoft patches and create malware. Windows 8 and Windows 10 machines aren't affected by this vulnerability. Let me repeat that. Windows 8 and 10 machines are not affected by this vulnerability. Microsoft broke from its tradition of not supplying patches for Windows operating systems that are out of support back when thousands of computers in more than 100 countries were affected by malware known as WannaCry. The malware used flaws in old versions of Windows to encrypt computers and demand a $300 ransom before unlocking it. Microsoft is clearly keen to avoid another WannaCry. Forewarned, take heed. Windows 10 cumulative update causes confusion by apparently installing itself twice. Affected are those running Windows 10, October 2018. Some Windows 10 users have encountered a problem with Microsoft's latest round of cumulative updates for the operating system. Specifically, it's with KB449441. That's Knowledge Base 449-4441, which is an important update for those running the October 2018 update. The issue here is that KB449441 is installed, and then the update is installed again by Windows 10. Update history then indicates there are two KB449441 updates installed, the second of which has a number 2 in brackets at the end of it. While this update still works fine, as reported by those experiencing the issue, it has unsurprisingly led to some confusion about exactly what's going on with the double installation. Essentially, what happens is that the cumulative update is actually a multi-stage process that requires an initial installation, followed by a reboot, and a further installation, and another reboot. This should just happen and be recorded as the installation of a single update. But there's a bug which is causing Windows Update to report that KB449-4441 has been installed twice, when in fact that isn't the case. There's no harm in this glitch, save for the confusion it has caused, but it would have been nice if Microsoft had provided a clear, official explanation with some visibility, rather than hiding it away in the middle of a convoluted Windows 10 info page. As to the resolution of the problem, Microsoft comments no action is required on your part. The update installation may take longer and may require more than one restart, but will install successfully after all intermediate installation steps have been completed. They are working on improving this update experience to ensure the update history correctly reflects the installation of the latest cumulative update. In other words, a fix should be in the pipeline to ensure that Windows update history simply reports this cumulative update as a single entity which has been installed. This is an important update, and that it's because it patches against what Microsoft described as a new subclass of speculative execution side channel vulnerabilities like Meltdown and Spectre. The latter is a fix designed to improve performance of Spectre Variant 2 mitigations, meaning that your PC hopefully won't be slowed down as much by said mitigations. So there are both important security and potential performance boosts in this cumulative update. So don't worry about it. It's in. It's okay. You need to look out for a new WhatsApp scam. WhatsApp is a secure app and its end-to-end encryption protects user privacy. The latest security features can only go so far. There is one element that will always remain vulnerable, even if an app is up to date with all the latest security features and protocols. That rogue element is the human factor that can help hackers break through even the most secure defenses. You need to look out for this one, or you can fall victim to it. WhatsApp hackers are trying to trick users into clicking fake links that will lock and steal their accounts. This latest WhatsApp warning is coming out of the Middle East, where the Telecommunications Authority of the UAE has published a warning against this new type of scam. Unfortunate victims have seen their WhatsApp accounts completely hijacked with hackers then able to read their messages and even scarier, send messages on their behalf. The scams work by sending a link to users who've recently installed WhatsApp on a new phone. What normally happens is WhatsApp sends a verification code to the user in order to prove their identity. In this case, however, the scammers are sending the code, along with a link, to users as a text message and asking them to click the link to prove their identity. The problems arise for users when they click the link. If you click the fake link, you could lose your WhatsApp account. Whenever a user clicks a link, they confirm to WhatsApp that it is them, but if they do it via the hacker, this then authorizes a hacker to control the user's WhatsApp account and freezes them out. The warning from the UAE says mobile users should not share the verification code that is sent to them by SMS, otherwise their account would be compromised. Many WhatsApp's accounts were hacked this way, and subscribers lost all their details. The scam has already claimed a lot of victims who no longer have control of their WhatsApp accounts. There are also reports that the scam has since been translated from Arabic into English and French, which means it's coming to the United States and Europe. You always need to be extremely careful when opening attachments and clicking links that you receive in messages, particularly when the message comes from somebody you don't know. Phishing scams, which try to trick you into handing over sensitive information, are on the rise globally. They've become increasingly sophisticated in recent times, meaning it is much harder now to spot scam attempts. When is it the best time of the year for getting the most bang for the buck when buying a personal computer? In other words, when are the best sale periods to get a good buy? Nothing causes buyer's remorse quite like seeing the laptop you bought last month at one price and it goes on sale for a substantially lower price the following month. But first, let's say that you are running a business or you have critical processing that is time sensitive. Then buy what is available. Don't wait for a sale. If your current notebook or desktop is physically inoperable or you have an immediate need for stronger performance, there's no good reason to delay your purchase. However, if you have a competent but aging unit that you plan to replace in the near future, you might save money or benefit from newer technology if you wait strategically. Back-to-school sales from major retailers like Amazon and Walmart are just beginning, and with Prime Day just a few weeks away, you're practically guaranteed to save money if you wait. The major PC manufacturers release new laptops 3 times a year. Back-to-school season from June to September, holiday season September to December, and spring from February to April. New models usually ship at the beginning or middle of these windows. However, the best deals tend to appear in July, August, and November, December, which are the heart of the school and holiday shopping seasons. You can expect to see better than average laptop deals from Amazon's Prime Day, which is likely to be held in mid-July. When the specials become available, be patient. Review what else is available and don't jump at the first sales special you see. Review carefully the specifications of the unit. Read the fine print. Read the reviews of the product. Not all reviews are legit or objective. Some reviews comment on what features may be missing. If the review is based on a purchase, why didn't they first read the product sheet? There are others who did not make the purchase and always have something to say about a product and they downgraded the product for a missing feature. Hey, that's just a subjective review that may or may not be relative to what your needs are. There are 5 major big box consumer electronic outlets that I've dealt with. They are B&H, Best Buy, Fry's, Micro Center, and Newegg in alphabetical order. With the exception of Newegg, the others all have local brick and mortar outlets. This enables me to physically examine and purchase the product locally before purchase and pick up at the store without waiting all day for delivery. I try to support the local retailers first. The absence of any physical computer outlets to review a computer product does not make for an intelligent decision. Having said all this, What is the impact of a tariff hike impact on the prices for PC parts? Whether you see actual price increases will depend on various factors, but some PC vendors already have manufacturing outside of China. It'll also take time for the tariff hike to ripple through product stock. So how might this affect your next PC purchase? The tariff list covers a lot of computer parts, including motherboards, graphic cards, CPU coolers, and even desktop cases. TVs, digital cameras, and internet modems have also been part of the list. But smartphones and fully assembled PCs have been spared. Whether you see an actual price increase will depend on various factors. For one, tariff hikes carves out an exemption for cargo ships that are already bound for the United States. The packaged goods on these ships will be tariffed at the original 10% rate. Retailers are also going through their existing stock of goods. So it'll take some time before the new import duties ripple through the industry product supplies. Still, it's true that many electronics are assembled in China. So to avoid the tariffs, some big-name vendors have already moved their product manufacturing to other countries. For instance, motherboard and graphic card maker ASUS has been shifting its manufacturing to Vietnam and Taiwan after the initial 10% tariff rate went into effect last September. The impact of the new tariff on ASUS will be minimal. Lenovo, on the other hand, already has a geographically diverse manufacturing base. This has allowed it to ship non-Chinese-made products to the United States and avoid the tariff altogether. They have factories in the United States, Mexico, China, Brazil, Hungary, and India. Dell had to raise some prices following the initial 10% tariff rate. That's because its company imports PC parts for its TC-based factories. They have passed that through to end users. Time will tell if the new tariff will cause a bigger impact, but of course it's also possible the White House would soon strike a deal with the Chinese government to resolve its ongoing trade war. But if you're interested in buying a PC, your traffic trade war is something that you have no control over, and there is no determination what the outcome will be. So instead of worrying about the tariff that may or may not happen, what you should do is stick to the original premise that if you need it, you buy it, and if you don't need it immediately, pick the right sales period and make your decision at that time. Products do change, pricing will change, and that is something that we have no control over. What countries have adopted Linux as their national operating system? There's China. China has a Chinese version of all popular web services. Baidu for Google, Weibo for Twitter, 51.com for Facebook. The list is endless. It's not surprising that China has its own operating system. It's Ubuntu Kylin. As the name suggests, Kylin is based on Ubuntu with extensive support for the Chinese language. The Chinese government adopted this in the year of 2013. Cuba has a national operating system, Nova, and it's also based on Ubuntu. This version is based on Nova 2015 and aims to be lightweight in order to replace Windows XP on older hardware, and hence it would be using LXDE desktop environment. North Korea has its own national operating system, also based on Linux, and it goes by the name of Red Star OS. It is being developed since year 2002. India, the world's biggest democracy, joins a list of communist countries to have its own Linux-based national operating system named BOSS, B-O-S-S, which stands for the Bharat Operating System Solutions, and it's a Debian-based Linux OS being developed by a government-owned organization for advanced computing development. Then you have Indonesia. The Research Center for Informatics, Indonesian Institute of Sciences, has developed IGOS, Nusantara Linux, to promote Linux in Indonesia. It is constantly being developed together with the community and has several variants, including exclusive support for the Internet of Things. Turkey has launched Pardus, P-A-R-D-U-S, Linux, back in 2005. It is developed by Turkish National Research Institute of Electronics and Cryptology in collaboration with Scientific and Technological Research Council of Turkey. And then there's a joint venture there by Russia and Iran. Both Russia and Iran were supposed to be working on their own national operating system based on Linux. But so far, there's no evidence of such an operating system being in use. South Korea has announced that they will now ditch Microsoft Windows for Linux. The South Korean government has reportedly decided to ditch Microsoft Windows entirely, according to the Korea Herald. The Asian country's government will switch from Windows 7 to a Linux-based operating system. They will test Linux extensively before switching. It is likely they will try various distributions before settling on just one. The reason for the switch is they anticipate lower operation expense. And then you have not a national government, now you have the city of Munich, who first initiated the adoption of Linux at the government level. Munich has made the announcement they will drop Linux and focus on only Windows. Why has Munich decided to go back to Windows? They had applications readily available for Windows, but not for any version of Linux. The moral is, you select the operating system your applications are available, and not select an operating system and ask what applications are available. And now Benjamin Rockwell presenting his IT Pro Series, the final chapter on tech support. This is part 5 of 5.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and I've been an IT professional for, well, longer than I care to admit. I'm here to impart my knowledge from both sides of the technical support experience to make your life better, easier, and help you challenge your tech problems. This is the last, part 5 in a 5-part series, on technical support and working it better for your advantage. If you missed any part of this, or even all of this, go back to the podcast, check out those previous items. In the past weeks, we talked about, well, there was part 1, that was an introduction to the characters in this grand drama. Part 2, preparing for your call. Part 3 was making the call. Part 4, escalations the right way. And this week, part 5 is about after the call. Now, I've done this so many times, and I want to give you a quick story before I continue. One technical support call was in regards to a computer virus that I had received on my bulletin board system many years ago. Just, it's a computer virus. And there was this guy up in the San Francisco Bay Area. He helped me with figuring out the problem, and he earned me as a friend. His name, John, still sticks in my mind to this day. He had a handful of people, maybe, I think he said it was 8 people who worked for him at the time. His company has since been sold for millions upon millions of dollars, but John McAfee, yes, that guy, the man behind McAfee, really made my day, or rather, late evening, back in about 1990. This is it. You've made it thus far. Your problem hopefully has been resolved in one way or another. All right, so we're at the end of this entire thing here. Following this path usually results in success. It's rarely going to end in failure. If it's a failure, I need you to shrug your shoulders. I need you to move on. There are many factors that we cannot account for in a series like this, in general life, in all of the world. This company may not care about technical support. What are you going to do? The technician may not have been the best that you've experienced. What are you going to do? The entire company may be falling apart. There's nothing you can do. On the other hand, you may have topped my past records of tech phone call experience and been on the phone for the better part of a day. My personal record, 6.5 hours. Your goal, if it's success, though, is not to end now, but to ensure that future calls are handled better, if not for you, but for someone else. You have a detailed account, and now it's time to thank all of the persons who helped you thus far. I want you to send an email if you have their addresses or someone's address. You remember those nice things I told you to write down? I want you to place them in this email. I want you to let people know your experience. I want you to build bridges. This is something that you've gone through all kinds of different things. You have had to reboot your system 17 times. You had to do this. You had to do that. You had to make this change, that change, install this patch, uninstall that software. It may have been a lot. And you've documented a ton. But one of those things was making notes all the way along. This is also the time where you apologize for any wrongs that you may have done along the way. You have a track record also in case this problem comes back. If this problem comes back, you've got an entire list of things that you can try before calling tech support again. Now, I did mention to write down your customer case number. This is something that's always important. You'll be given that frequently as well. This is something that you can tie back so that people who are looking at your letter can see. You can use this as a reference point later on for you to get additional tech support if this problem comes back. Unfortunately, the problem may never have been resolved in the first place. And I know it's frustrating at this time. But I want you to remember patience. I want you to remember your virtue. I want you to remember the kindness that you expressed that got you this far. I want you to take what you've been provided here by your own hand. And I want you to note down how you might have done better. I also want you to go that extra mile for your next phone call. See what you can do to improve on this experience and see if you can find a way to improve upon what I've given you here. You may be amazed. Now, I want you to also send in a letter documenting your success. If this is, you know, just a simple thing, yeah, they told me to reboot and it fixed it. Okay, don't send in a letter. But if you spent 2 hours, 3 hours working on this, it really helps the process. It helps the long term of this company. And in effect, it'll help all customer service companies and representatives and all of this to become better if you just send in that letter documenting your success and your thanks for all of the people who solved your very important problem. And yeah, sure, they may ignore it, or they may put it up on the wall as one of their history of successes. It spreads the word. It helps them get better. It helps you feel better, as long as you're being nice. Don't be mean. You know that John McAfee guy? I opened up talking about him this week. He may not remember me this many years later. I'm fairly sure he doesn't remember this guy who called in 1990 and said, hey, I'm having a problem with this particular virus. But you know what? I remember him. I remember my experience with him, not just because it was John McAfee, but just because he was going out of his way to help me. I want you to remember the technicians who helped you in your support call in that same way, with kindness of thought, with fondness for a great experience. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. On this day in history, May 22nd, 1990, Microsoft released Windows 3.0. Let's go back 6 years and review the Windows genesis. Mac OS System 1.0 was released in 1984. It was System 1.0 was the first operating system GUI developed for the Macintosh. It had several features of a modern operating system, being Windows-based with icons. In response to the Apple operating system, Windows 1.0 was released on November the 20th, 1985. As the first version of the Microsoft Windows line, it ran on a graphical 16-bit multitasking shell on top of an existing MS-DOS installation. It provided an environment which can run graphical programs designed for Windows as well as existing MS-DOS software. Windows 1.0 was released to mixed reviews. Most critics consider the platform to have future potential, but that Windows 1.0 had not fulfilled expectations. Many reviews criticize its demanding system requirements, especially noting the poor performance experience when running multiple applications at once, and that Windows encouraged the use of a mouse for navigation, a relatively new concept at the time. The New York Times compared the performance of Windows on a system with 512 KB of RAM to pouring molasses in the Arctic, and that its design was inflexible for keyboard users due to its dependency on a mouse-oriented interface. In conclusion, the New York Times felt that the poor performance, lack of dedicated software, uncertain compatibility with DOS programs, and a lack of tutorials for new users made DOS-based software more desirable for most PC users. In retrospect, Windows 1.0 was regarded as a flop by contemporary technology publications, who, however, still acknowledge its overall importance to the history of the Windows line. Windows 1.0 ran atop of MS-DOS as a layer. In 1987, Microsoft released Windows 2.0, which was designed for the Intel 286 processor. This version added desktop icons, keyboard shortcuts, and improved graphics support. The first two releases of Windows, when compared to Mac OS, well, they were pedestrian and the releases were largely ignored by the public. Now advance forward to 1990. Windows 3.0, a graphic user environment, is the third major release of Microsoft Windows. It became the first widely successful version of Windows and a rival to Apple's Macintosh and the Commodore Amiga on the graphical user interface front. It was followed shortly by Windows 3.1. The inclusion of games like Solitaire and Minesweeper on early versions of Windows was no happy coincidence. Sure, it gave millions of computer users across the globe the perfect excuse to procrastinate, but their presence on Windows served as a much larger and interesting purpose. Though Apple brought the mouse mainstream when it introduced the Mac in 1984, the platform's relatively small market share meant that most computer users were still unfamiliar with a standard GUI. So when Microsoft introduced Windows 3.0 in 1990, it included Microsoft Solitaire as a fun way to get consumers accustomed to basic computer functions like dragging and dropping. Microsoft put Solitaire in Windows to soothe people's intimidated by the operating system. Recall that for many users, Windows 3.0 represented an entirely new user interface environment with no command prompt in sight. So in addition to providing end users with a fun distraction, Solitaire also taught them how to use a mouse. So there you have it, the history of Solitaire on Windows Explained. In fact, Solitaire has become such an entrenched part of Windows experience that there was a collective uproar, albeit brief, when word spread that using Microsoft Solitaire Collection Premium Edition without ads on Windows 10 would require a subscription. Alas, there is a method to Microsoft's madness. Many have been afflicted with playing Solitaire. Let's not forget today is also National Solitaire Day. Solitaire is a classic card game that's been played for hundreds of years, but it wasn't until 1990 when Microsoft included in Windows 3.0. Prior to the advent of Windows 3.0, IBM OS 2 was intended to replace the older disk operating system, DOS. This was back in 1987. IBM OS 2 was to be developed by IBM and Microsoft to operate the second generation line of IBM personal computers, the PS2 or otherwise known as Personal Systems 2. OS 2 combined a new graphical user interface. Simultaneously, Microsoft continued development of its Windows operating system, whose popular third iteration, Windows 3.0, contained some of the GUI elements developed for OS 2. Despite later basing some Windows NT and Windows 95 developments on code written for IBM and OS 2, Microsoft soon discontinued development of further interface features for OS 2. With Microsoft focusing its efforts on Windows, IBM turned to Commodore business machines for interface development and borrowed GUI design ideas from the Commodore Amiga OS. OS 2 was developed with a staff of 1,800 over three continents, with an emphasis of it being integral to an enterprise operating environment. After 7 years of development, in 1994, IBM introduced OS 2 Warp, which included many new features. OS 2, however, failed to acquire a share of the mass market. It survived in IBM-dominated niche markets such as ATM or automated teller machines, but the company halted production in 2005 and support in 2006. OS 2 support was released as open source, but Microsoft retains rights to some of the code, and the security of ATMs could be compromised. At the time, the battle was relevant in the very early 1990s. Microsoft was seen as the radical upstart with a friendlier operating system with better usability and a lower cost, whereas IBM had the reputation of the corporate culture and was no longer being viewed as the innovator. OS 2 early on also developed a reputation as a resource hog that would only run on expensive and powerful hardware. Microsoft also learned early on how to court the independent software developer community. No apps means no installed base, which means nobody else would write apps either, and therefore no virtual cycle. OS 2 never had a truly meaningful selection of general-purpose consumer apps, aside from ports of WordPerfect and Lotus 1-2-3. Once Microsoft put all its chips behind Windows, there were no more Microsoft apps for OS 2. You just can't be that late to the market, even with a good product, if you want to retain a healthy consumer app ecosystem. The lesson to be learned here is that people don't buy an operating system, they buy an application, and what their application runs on may be the operating system they're using. And the operating system is incidental to the application that's required to use it. With the Internet of Things and home automation, we are connecting many more devices. And to meet the extra electrical requirements, some are replacing 15-amp circuit breakers with 20-amp circuit breakers with the assumption that they have upgraded their electrical capacity. Most housing units with original 15-amp circuit breakers are attached to 14-gauge wires. Changing the circuit breaker without replacing the 14-gauge wire with 12-gauge wire is not advisable. When the circuit is overloaded, instead of the circuit tripping, the equipment continues to run, causing the wires and the connected devices to overheat. This shortens the life of the equipment and it can cause a fire. Marty gives us a heads up on this precaution.
I'm sorry. I know the last time I said I would be talking about flooring this time, but I've got a meeting and I'm picking up a lot of new information about flooring technologies that I'll share with you in a week or two. Tonight, I want to wire you into things you'd rather not hear about your house wiring and what you can do about them. Can you remember from the filaments in classic incandescent light bulbs how hot those bulbs would get? Do you remember seeing wires glow in an electric stove or an electric oven or a hot plate or a space heater or a toaster? When you connect these things to power, the electricity makes them hot. You've seen it, but maybe not all of it. By the time I finish this segment, see if you aren't surprised by what you learned here. But I'll start slowly so you can get a sense of how and why this stuff happens. What's behind these surprises? In part, it's a case of no place like home to enforce the law of Mr. Georg Ohm, who published what we now know as Ohm's Law in 1827. It has to do with a concept called resistance. Resistance, as you might expect, means fighting back against things that are trying to happen. When the thing that's trying to happen is the flow of electricity, resistance reduces that flow. It does so by eating up some of the electrical energy. And the electrical energy that it manages to eat up, it gets things that it's flowing through to heat up. That's what resistance does most often. Have you ever heard of a multimeter, a volt-ohm milliammeter? You can measure how much current goes through a wire. Don't try this with your power lines. You can measure the voltage there. If you're very careful or experienced, you may be able to do that safely. But in order to measure the resistance, well, that's beyond most people. So you look up the charts of the resistance per foot or per 1,000 feet of various wire sizes, and you can calculate what you've got based on the length of your run. Sometimes you find that out by measuring the wall and ceiling distances they run through. Did you connect all those dots? That's right. The heating elements in all of those appliances I named, stoves and ovens and toasters and so on, those are big resistors. They resist the flow of electricity, and the energy that doesn't pass through becomes heat. Making things get hot is one of the oldest tricks in electricity's book. What Herr Ohm taught us is the relationship of volts of electrical charge, amps of current flow, and a third value, named after him, called ohms, that measures resistance. In simple math terms, you don't have to take notes, there won't be a snap quiz. In simple math terms, voltage in volts is the product, meaning you multiply, of multiplying current in amps times resistance in ohms. Two of these three are also addressed in a contribution from another pioneer, James Watt. And ever since, it's been called Watt's Law. It says that power in watts is the product of multiplying current in amps times voltage in volts. That's a whole stack of the most common electrical values, watts, volts, ohms, and amps, all tied together in two simple equations. So what does that have to do with wiring? Doesn't wiring just connect and conduct? You might not think of wiring as being anything other than a highway for electricity, not really a place to think about watts and ohms and all that, but that ain't so. The law's a law, especially in physics and electronics, where Ohm's law and Watt's law can lead to some unwanted encounters with Murphy's law. Let's go to the wall. You may remember that most of the wiring in houses tends to be either white-jacketed 14-gauge Romex wire, which should be controlled by a 15-amp breaker and never carry more than 12 amps. One more time, 14-gauge is white-jacketed. It should be on a 15-amp breaker, never carry more than 12 amps. Yellow-jacketed 12-gauge, it's thicker, can go on a 20-amp breaker, but it should never carry more than 16 amps. For most household wiring, just remember, yellow is mellow, but white is a fright. Yellow is mellow, but white is a fright. I said that because I kept finding the wrong kind of wiring being fed by 20-amp breakers. I looked up a key specification for these two varieties of Romex, ran the numbers, and frankly, the results startled me. Thinner, white-jacketed 14-gauge Romex made to connect 15-amp breakers to 15-amp breakers, controlled by them, never delivering more than 12 amps. Well, those have a room temperature resistance of 2.6 ohms per 1,000 feet. Sounds like a small number, but we're not done yet. The key number there is 2.6. By comparison, the thicker, yellow-jacketed 12-gauge Romex made to run, you know, under the control of 20-amp breakers, is only 1.6 ohms per 1,000 feet. 2.6 versus 1.6. I'll come back to those numbers in a minute. Now, your house probably doesn't have a 1,000-foot-long wire run. The longest might be 500 feet. So let me set this up. If you have the thinner white Romex wiring on a 20-amp breaker where it doesn't belong, even if you load it with just short of 20 amps of draw, just enough to keep the breaker from tripping, that's 2,400 watts on a 120-volt power line. The breaker won't trip. But remember, the wire is also a resistor, granted a really low-value resistor. On the other hand, the amount of power getting eaten by that resistor doesn't just follow current. It follows the square of current. With a 20-amp draw, the wiring itself, the wiring in your walls, becomes a 520-watt heater on that run and on every other run like it. Actually, it's more than that, because the hotter a wire get, the higher its resistance becomes. And the resistance in the wiring also drops the voltage that reaches your outlets, in this case, by 26 volts. That's a brownout condition that isn't the electric utility's fault, it's the electrician's fault. In the same circumstances, yellow Romex is a little better. On a 20-amp draw, it's only a 320-watt heater instead of 520 watts, and it only drops the voltage to your outlets by 16 volts instead of 26 volts. Still, neither is what you wanted. And keep this in mind. The wattage that heats the wiring takes away from the wattage available to the things that are plugged in. It's a power vampire. Plus, it's also your own homegrown brownout, and worse. Okay, let's pull back a little. You should only ever load a circuit to a maximum of 80% of a breaker's capacity. So that's 16 amps on a 20-amp breaker, 12 amps on a 15. That cuts the heating by the White is a Fright Romex from 520 watts to 333 watts, and cuts the heating by the Yellow is Mellow Romex from 320 watts to just 204 watts. A little less dangerous, a little less wasteful, but still making your HVAC system work a little harder. Whatever the draw and whatever the current, the thinner wire is going to eat up 60% more power and turn it into heat. Even cruising at just 5 amps, meaning the plugged-in stuff is drawing 600 watts, the wiring will add 32.5 watts if it's thinner, just 20 watts if it's thicker. Meaning the meter is costing you 5.4% more juice than the things you have plugged in are really using on the thin wire, just 3.3% on the thick wire. Too many numbers? Let's get to cases. The more current there is on any one line, the more your cost penalty rises. Things like stoves, heaters, hot water, hair dryers, those things can pull a lot of current. And that isn't plug by plug, it's for everything on the line that connects back to the breaker. Splitting it into more runs from more breakers can cut way down on the waste. Thicker wire everywhere brings a 10 to 15% drop in vampire power becoming waste heat. It also means that if later you do have to plug something in that needs more power, you'll have the wiring to handle it. You'll have the reserve capacity. At my project house, almost every inch of wiring is the thicker Romex. It will heat up less, so it will be less of a burden on the air conditioning. And hey, it will also do less heating and drying along its run that can more quickly age those parts of a house. It will help slow the electric meter by 10 to 15%. It will keep the voltage at the outlets nearer the values that equipment expects to see. And it will give me the freedom to add more outlets without overburdening the run. In fact, I just tore out the original 24-position breaker box and put in a new 60-position box. The old one had a lot of half-size breakers. The new one has all full-size breakers, and many of them are twinned where the electrician finds that appropriate. He also wired in my Total Protection Solutions brand Whole House Surge Protector. And he added 10 new wiring runs to the office and lab space, to the attic, to the equipment room, and to the basement utility areas. My bumper sticker for this is Run Light to Run Long. Got that? Run light to run long, meaning the less you load any one run, the longer the run can be and the longer it can be trouble-free. Next time, my new office and test bench lab space take on the added role of being TV production studios for some new series that will start airing in July. How I'm shooting, my crazy collection of cameras, lighting, acoustics, I'm still straightening all of that out. And I've already begun shooting, but I think you may be interested in hearing about, at least, my shooting pains, and what I'm doing to address them.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. HamFest 2019, Sunday, June the 2nd, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the New York Hall of Science. How do you get there? You take the number 7 Flushing subway line, and you get off at 111th Street. It's one stop before Mets Field, Willets Point, previously known as Shea Stadium. Admission is $5 and free for children under 12 years of age. And the following are computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these club meetings are open free to the public. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on a look back at the club's history and a personal journey. Thursday, May the 23rd. They meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. The Princeton PC Users Group has their meeting on Tuesday, May the 28th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society has their meeting on Tuesday, June the 4th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace, 158 Main Street, Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC User Group will have a presentation on Ada's driverless cars, Thursday, June the 6th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Keller Williams Realty at 120 Bloomingdale Road, White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their meeting on Friday, June the 7th. They meet at 8 p.m. and they meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey. Computer Learning Center at Ewing has a presentation on Apple seeds and Apple devices, and it's Tuesday, June the 11th. Meeting time is 2 p.m., and they meet at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. The Kings Bite Computer Club meets Tuesday, June the 11th, at 7 p.m., and they meet at the Park Plaza Restaurant, 220 Cadman Plaza West, Brooklyn, New York. The New York Amateur Computer Club has a general meeting on Thursday, June the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at NYU Silver Building at 32 Waverly Place, located in Manhattan, New York. And the Long Island Macintosh Users Group has their meeting on Friday, June the 14th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. at the Harry J. Scherer Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus in Old Westbury, New York. If you have a computer club meeting that you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet. If you have any questions for us or commentary on any of our feature segments, just send us your email address with your telephone number in which we can call you at a convenient hour for playback on the program. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There's no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy. Until we meet again, same time, same station next week.